Please meet our panelists. Nikki Patan is the executive director of Calling All Crows, Kelly Clegg, manager of Tim McGraw and founder of Safe Tour, and Dana Frank, CEO of First Avenue and co-founder of NEVA, the National Independent Venue Association. Thanks for being here, everyone. I'd love for each of you to introduce yourself and speak a little bit about what your organization or company does.
Hey, everybody. I am Nikki. Give it a second.
Picking up.
Check, check, check. That's better. All right. Hey, how's it going, everyone? How you guys doing? Good, 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 good. I'm the executive director of Calling All Crows. We're a nonprofit that's been around since 2008. And basically, the easiest way to understand what we do is that we connect music fans and the music industry to liberation and feminist social justice movements. You guys don't know anything about what that means at all, but I'll give you my business card and you'll figure it out.
My name is Dana Frank. I'm the owner, CEO of First Avenue in Minneapolis, Minnesota. We have about 6 venues that we operate and own all in the Minneapolis-St. Paul area. We do about 1,200 shows a year in Minnesota. And then when the pandemic hit, along with Audrey Fick Schaefer and Toby Parks and Katie Tutton in the audience, formed the National Independent Venue Association, rallying 3,000 independent venues, promoters, festivals across the country to garner political support that resulted in the Save Our Stages bill, $16 billion to keep our industry alive.
Yes. Oh, love that.
And I'm Kelly Clegg. I'm the senior vice president of MCO, who's an entertainment management company that focuses mainly on Tim McGraw. And I'm the executive director of a nonprofit called Safe Tour that I started in 2019, basically as a way to create a resource and tools for artists and managers to put sexual harassment, discrimination training into touring protocol. And that's been our goal ever since.
Thank you. Okay, so we're going to start a journey here together on this topic. And beyond my own personal experiences, I started learning more about what was being done in this space and what I could do last summer when I was part of a mentorship program through She Is the Music. And my mentee, Christina London, who's over there helping behind the scenes, wanted to create a project that would work towards furthering sexual harassment-free live music spaces, both researching what was being done already and figuring out a way of implementing protocols on a greater scale across the industry. And this is how I learned about what these amazing people on the panel are doing. So first, I'd like to take you along on my initial step, and that's language, definitions. What is the definition of sexual harassment, gender-based discrimination, and what are some of the statistics that will help lay some baseline for our journey? So I was hoping, Nikki, that you could help start us off with a definition of sexual harassment and maybe how it fits into the larger context of different types of discrimination.
Yeah, thank you, Amy. So sexual harassment, as all of us should know by now, is illegal. It is not a thing that you are legally allowed to do. However, that doesn't matter because people do it anyway. And it is a spectrum of behaviors. And that is somebody who is causing some sort of harm to you on whatever basis. So it could be sexual orientation, it could be gender identity, it could be because they think you're really fine and they are very inappropriate in the way that they want to convey that to you. It can be somebody who is in a position of power, who is then exerting that power over you. So a boss or a manager or just somebody who has that power. Another way that I think of it too, you know, artists have a lot of power in this vein. So folks who have more social or cultural capital can be sexual harassers. Different types. I mean, it's anything that's unwelcome, you know, and I think that's what makes sexual harassment so hard for people to understand, is that they want these like clear, hard lines of what it is and what it's not. But really, it's anything that makes you feel uncomfortable, that causes harm, that you feel like you cannot do anything about necessarily. Right. So you might be, for example, if you are somebody who is like on a tour and you are part of the crew and somebody is sexually harassing you as part of that crew, but y'all are traveling together, what do you do, right? So sexual harassment really is kind of amorphous. It's hard to pin it down. It's hard to like put your finger on it. But much like, I don't know, things like porn, you sort of know it when you see it, and you kind of know it when you feel it. And really, I think the biggest thing, like the biggest takeaway, is that it sort of interrupts what somebody is just trying to do, right? Like it stops you in your tracks. So, you know, if you're performing, it can stop you in your tracks doing that. If you're just a fan, it can make your concert or your live music experience terrible. Or if you're somebody who's like just working like in an office, it can be a barrier for you getting that work done. One thing I wanted to say too and acknowledge that I think is rarely acknowledged is that sexual harassment is not just about gender, sexuality, gender expression, identity, all of that. It also intersects with other forms of discrimination. So I'm going to toss out a very academic word that we've all probably heard, which is intersectionality, which is how like oppressions and lived experiences and identities kind of intersect and connect. I actually hate the definition of intersectionality. I love the concept because I love Sojourner Truth and Kimberly Crenshaw, who coined the term. But in my experience, intersectionality is more like an amalgamation. It's all kind of crushed together. And like whatever aggression or microaggression someone is directing to me, I don't know what they're responding to that day. Is it because I'm black? Is it because I'm queer? Is it because I'm non-binary, a single parent, fat, they don't like my shoes? I don't know. Or is it some combination of all of that? And so I think if you can think of it like that, especially when it comes to sexual harassment, particularly in the response to it, right? That intersectionality, that amalgamation of identities, discrimination, makes it difficult sometimes for people to respond in ways that are appropriate. So can limit somebody's ability to be empathetic, to believe that you're experiencing sexual harassment, to believe that the person who harassed you actually harassed you. All those dynamics come into play when it comes to sexual harassment.
Yeah, I think that that's a really important place to start here also, mm-hmm. so that it doesn't feel like we're just talking about one thing. But in a way to not be overwhelmed by it, we are focusing on sexual harassment right now. But I think that that's a really important way to kind of like look at it from a 30,000 foot view, that there's a lot more at play when things are happening. So I want to kind of set the scene into a concert space, any live music environment, who is there, who makes up the ecosystem. The next slide outlines some stats on people's concert going experiences. And I wanted to ask Kelly if you could kind of set the scene for the concert space we're in and who's with us front of house and backstage and, you know, who are we talking about that are at play here?
Sure. So whether it's your favorite local club venue, it could be the theater where the symphony plays, it could be an amphitheater, it could be a stadium, it could be an arena. Pick one of those in your mind and then divide up the room from the front lip of the stage back, mm-hmm. so to the back of the house. So you think about the artist, the band, everything that goes all the way back to maybe the buses and the trucks. Mm-hmm. And then think of everything that goes forward from the stage. So people, which we would call the front of house. Back of house, front of house, or, sorry, I'm super dyslexic, so you just take it whichever way you want to take it. But so then if you go from that front lip of the stage outward, you would have fans, you would have some people working, maybe doing sound out in the venue. You might have the concourse, people working in the concourse, fans in the concourse. And the interesting thing about the music space is that there are different sort of heads of state for each of these spaces, right? So someone might own the actual physical venue. That same person might be the promoter, but it might be different. So let's say you had someone that owned the physical space, then you had the promoter who came into that physical space to put on the show. They'd be overseeing the production. So they would hire local hands, local, maybe a runner. Maybe they've hired the local security, the local vendors who sell you beer and popcorn or whatever else it is, depending on which venue you're at. Then as you get from that back, that lip of the stage towards the back of the house, you'd have the artist. And most of the folks that come in from out of town for that show, they've got, they're under the purview of the artist and the artist management. So you'd have the artist themselves, maybe a band, could be dancers, background singers, it depends on how big that production is. You might have a tour manager, a production manager, hair, makeup, clothing, video vendors, sound vendors. You know, on the artist side, tours are comprised of a bunch of third parties, that come together to make this spectacular six-month tour, however long it is. So you've got a lot of different people functioning in that. When we call it live music, you might think of it as a fan, you might think of it as an artist, you might think of it as having worked in that space where you went in for the day or for the week to work a venue or work a space. And because of that, HR gets tricky because everybody's sort of in charge of their own HR, which a lot of times means nobody is, which is how the music business has functioned for many, many years on the artist and the management side. Or maybe for instance, it's a Live Nation venue who's a really big company, and so maybe you do sexual harassment training, but it's very specific to what happens in front of the copy machine or at the water cooler, you know, things that feel really foreign to walking through a venue from, you know, 4 p.m. to 2 a.m. in the morning and putting in 10 godzillion steps. You know, it's not the same environment. So you've got a lot of different areas and a lot of different ways to think about those people, and then a lot of different power structures within.
And I'm assuming that since you're all here, you've all been in one of these spaces before, even if it's just as a fan. So you're kind of getting maybe a bigger picture of all of the different people involved in that space. I wanted to go from that to talking to Dana about what First Avenue has implemented and done with Calling All Crows to set up protocols and make your spaces safer, and you know, go from that point of view where you're looking at the whole piece of it, and to kind of like focus on what is happening in the promoter venue world specifically with what you're doing with Calling All Crows.
I mean, first of all, I just want to say thank God for Calling All Crows. We would have been totally lost. We Minneapolis had a kind of a reckoning amongst our music scene. I would say like a couple months after George Floyd, I think, you know, it was, everything was tense and people felt very bold and brave and like change could come. Mm-hmm. And so a lot of the local musicians, like, you know, the really brave young women started sharing their stories, like, and then, you know, finding out that it wasn't an isolated incident. And so there was just this giant where like people who had been playing the clubs, who had been considered friends, like all of these stories started getting revealed that like, you know, we had no clue. It was genuinely pretty shocking. And so it was, let's see, August 2020. So at First Avenue, we were like, we better take a total wholesale inventory of like how we're doing, what we're doing. We were closed at the time. So like, it was actually a very good moment, you know, for us to like be able to readdress. We had, I think, 8 employees left. So like nothing was off the table. We could totally like change our handbook. We could do everything. And so we started, we did some all female non-binary gender non-conforming staff forums just to hear, like, I should say former staff at the time, but like, how were we doing? What were your experiences like? Total safe space. Nothing's off the table. And I think because they weren't employed at the time, we heard stories that like I have never been so ashamed and like so devastated in my life to hear what had happened at the venue. And I thought like, I'm a female business owner, we're, you know, this is great. And like the stories I heard, some of it predated me. We were like, we just need to like throw everything out and start over again. And so we're like, okay, what venue in the country has done this that we can just like, you know, work off of? And like, no one had anything. And so we were referred to actually by an employee, like, have you heard of Calling All Crows? They're doing really cool work. And so we reached out, and Kim walked us through like the whole process from top to bottom. So after the forum, we were like, we need a wholesale, complete 180-degree shift in everything we've been doing. We put into effect a code of conduct that was written by staff members and includes everything from what you would think of to intentional misgendering to, you know, no Confederate symbolism, like everything that we could think of. And we have that. You have to check a box when you buy your ticket. You agree to the code of conduct. We have it at our front door. We have it in our artist contracts. Everybody, employees, fans, artists, are subject to this code of conduct. And then we created a booking policy, with Calling All Crows, so that it was really important to us to make sure that we treated all artists the same, whether it was a local artist, your first show ever with 10 people in the audience, or, you know, Billy Strings that has two sold out 6,000 cap shows. Like, so we have red violations, yellow violations, orange. So if you violate it, there's a policy that we can go through to ensure that everyone's treated the same, but also that there is accountability and follow up. And believe it or not, we reopened July 2021, and within the first week, we had a violation, both customer violation and artist violation. And so we got to put it into effect, and we've been massaging it. And you know, as Kim would tell us, like, nothing's ever final, and there's no such thing as a zero tolerance policy, because there's always blurred lines, and blurred lines is not the right term. There's always gray area in our industry. So we just are constantly updating it, perfecting it, and trying to do better.
Man. I wish Sorry, everybody was doing that.
it's what happened.
Yeah. I mean, that's a really great example of what the work that Calling All Crows is doing. And Kim, I just want to mention that Kim is someone else with Calling All Crows.
sorry.
But it's fine.
We're really good friends, actually. She still works for the organization. We get along.
But I also, I wanted to kind of dive in a little bit deeper with what Calling All Crows is doing and what Safe Tour is doing and just clarify the differences. So I'd love for you to each talk about, like, who your target audience is for your training sessions that you guys do. And then also any examples of, you know, venues or, I mean, beyond, I think, the stellar example, First Avenue, but any other examples of artists that you've partnered with or other collaborations that have been successful that, you know, we could all kind of, you know, understand and connect to?
Yeah, for sure.
Want to start?
You want to go first?
Okay.
Thank you, Kelly. So we have an online training program called the Here for the Music campaign. And so that is directed towards music fans, and it's also directed towards folks who are based within a venue, so are staying with the same venue. It was really important to us to have training that was accessible to people, so you don't always need to, like, fly us to where you're at or schedule, like, a Zoom call. That's really hard, especially for folks in the arts and especially in the music industry. And so for us, it's important for fans to understand how sexual harassment works when they're in the space. Because it can go in so many different directions. Obviously, folks can sexually harass each other as fans, but something that folks don't talk about often is how artists can be affected by that sexual harassment. So we've heard of an artist who is a really soft singer, you know, just very, like, acoustic, and so the sound is really amped up. And so in their ears, like, on the stage, they could hear people in the audience talking about what they wanted to do to them as they were performing, which is something that I don't think people think about, right? You think you're having, like, a private conversation or you're just making, like, a comment to your friend, and little do you know, this person can hear it. You can apply that to everybody who's around you, right? So it's really, I think, a matter of, like, showing up with integrity, and that's what we train people to do, is how, you know, how do we make it so that, like, when we're in a venue, when we're working at a venue, when we're a fan in a venue and just enjoying the show, how can we just all be here for the music? Because ultimately, that is what we're there for. We're there to see a live show. We're there to have fun. We're there to, like, have a good time. What we're not there to do is to walk away feeling harmed or feeling traumatized or feeling like that's a space that we can never come back into, right? And so I think that's another impact of sexual harassment that people don't think about, that depending on the interaction, depending on what's happened, you can completely color, you can completely shift somebody's entire trajectory of how they, you know, interact with venues, how they even move around their city. And to me, you know, as an artist, I'm a singer-songwriter, but I'm also a poet. And so I've had the privilege and the honor of, like, teaching young poets for the past, like, 20 years. And one sort of unintended impact that they've experienced is that due to some of the sexual harm they've experienced at the hands of other poets or artists or sexual harassment at events, it stops them from showing up. They stop coming. And that sucks, honestly. Like, we're here to inspire people and lift people up and connect through music and through creativity. If they experience an incident of sexual harassment, that can be the thing that stops them from going to live shows, stops them from engaging music, and that can maybe prevent us from, like, having, like, the next great fill-in-your-favorite artist here, right? So I think, like, you have to think of it as, like, that continuum as well, that it has much more impact beyond just the space. So for us, What we handle the folks that come to the shows, and then we handle the folks that are receiving the folks that come to the shows that are based in whatever city that they're in.
Thanks. Mm-hmm. Kelly, yeah, safe tour.
Yes. Nikki's my hero. So as an artist manager, I really approached it from the artist side. One of the things that was happening is, as I was sitting there talking with a friend and where Safe Tour really came from, was this idea that, you know, the music business loves to say, like, oh, this is how we've always done it. Oh, you know, this is how we've always done it. Like, we love to kind of root back in that, which is dumb. And not true, right? Like, we're not sending merch reports via fax machines in hotel lobbies anymore. So it's not how we've always done it.
I got your telegram this morning.
Oh, good. I'm glad it went through. And so, you know, as I looked at it, and I looked at some of the protocols that we had built over the course of the last 6 or 8 years, we built in social media protocol. We built in behind-the-scenes photography and videography protocol. And that wasn't hard to do because it was really important to us that people didn't post random things backstage that we didn't like, right? So we sat everybody down and we told them, this is really important. But then it's stunning that as I looked around, literally and almost art contradict each other. I could only find one artist at the time who had any sort of procedure in place, who admittedly said, the tour manager said, yeah, you know, I wish I could tell you we did this because we're good folks, but we did it because we had an issue and we had to go in and correct it. And he's like, I'm glad we did. I'm glad, you know, and they were the only, it was only one artist that I, of all the artists I had talked to at the time, who had put any kind of harassment and discrimination training in for their tour, for their crew. So Safe Tour, the way we approached it was to say, artists are the leaders. We're the cultural leaders. We invent things. We invent music. We invent things that have never been done before. So let's invent a protocol, put it onto tour. It's just really simple. Train your crew. First, make sure that your crew knows it's important. Train your crew. Level everybody up so that if you're going to ask them to meet new expectations, you give them new information to meet those expectations. And then put really simple accountability practices in place. Be clear. Be transparent about what those are. It's interesting, the point that you're making about, a lot of times you don't hear this from, well, I won't get into that. You hear from some people that we don't have a problem anymore. Like, oh, we're doing pretty good. I don't know. I mean, touring's doing pretty good nowadays, right? Like, we've really evolved. And it's not true. You know, I mean, I sat with an intern last week and she's 20 and she said, she's like, oh yeah, you know, I was on the road for a little bit and I came off the road. I stopped doing that job because I couldn't handle a situation. I didn't know who to tell about it. Mm-hmm. And in the same way, you know, that next great artist manager or production manager or mm-hmm. lighting director or video director is now doing something else because they didn't feel safe and they didn't feel comfortable to work in this space. So I think there's that. And I think also in the same way, the touring space is, you know, there's very little margin for error. There's, it's a 24/7, you know, you're on a bus, you're living, breathing, maybe you're lucky enough to be on a bus, maybe you're in a van, but you're living together. And it's really, it's sort of an elite athlete is how I look at it. You know, I mean, you're talking about people that are really great at what they do. They're the very best in sound engineers. They're the very best musicians. They're the very best technical and video directors. And over the course of the last 10 years, the scope of who's in that space has changed. You know, I mean, thank God you see more women, more people of color, more diversity across the board. And then yet you still have a group of people that haven't necessarily been given new training skills to understand how to talk amongst themselves, how to handle situations, who to go to within their immediate power structure of who they talk to, people that don't feel protected to that they're, are they going to lose their job? If I tell my tour manager what happened, is that person going to lose their job? Because I also don't want to get them fired. I just want them to stop commenting on blah, blah, blah every day. And so really what we've tried to do is we're just trying to put together the tools. I mean, really, back to that same thing, I looked around and I was like, okay, who's got it? Oh, nobody. Like, literally nobody. There is no best practices handbook for touring and sexual harassment, discrimination, and accountability.
Okay, that's really great segue. What's standing in the way? I mean, like, what's standing in the way from trainings happening, people taking trainings, and programs being put in place, protocols being put in place, and for it to become routine and standard in this industry? What are those steps that that need to be taken, and why aren't people taking them?
I have a couple things to say about that. Well, I have a lot to say about a lot of things, but about this specifically, I think the first thing that's standing in the way is people admitting that it is an actual problem, right? Because the thing is that if we admit that it's an actual problem, then we have to actually do something about it. And also, it's a problem that does not exist outside of ourselves. So I think that when it comes to the conversation on sexual violence in general, but certainly sexual harassment, there's a tendency to do this, like, binary. I hate binaries, period. But, like, there's a, you know, good versus evil. You're a harm doer. You're someone who's been harmed. The real thing is that all of us have caused harm to someone on some level for some reason around something. And some of us, you know, have experienced harm, right? All of us have either been a harm doer or we have been harmed. So that's the first thing that we have to get rid of, is that binary of good versus evil. It doesn't work, and it's unrealistic, and it's one of the reasons why people are sort of afraid to take a run at the problem directly, exactly because of what you said, right? I'm going to get somebody fired. Someone's going to go to jail. I don't want to ruin someone's life. I can't tell you how many times I've heard that. Let me let you in on a little secret. As somebody who's worked in sexual violence advocacy for about 20 years now, hardly anybody goes to jail for rape. Certainly not for sexual harassment. Honestly, not a thing. And when it comes to, like, ruining people's lives, the only person typically whose life gets ruined is the person who's experienced harm. And also, I can say this too, as part of the gender-based violence community, we do a very crap job at supporting people who are not cisgender, heterosexual women who have been affected by sexual violence. And so when I say that, I mean men who have been sexually harassed or violated, we don't support them. We don't support folks who are LGBTQ or non-binary or trans, we don't support them. There's not a lot of mechanisms in place. So when it comes to, like, taking a run and solving this problem, the first thing that we have to do is say, hey, it's a problem, and everybody has the potential to be affected by it. That's one. The second thing is money. I'm gonna say it one more time, close to the microphone. Money, okay? Because it takes a lot of time. It also takes a lot of what we call emotional labor to sit with people as they kind of take in this new information, these statistics that you saw of, like, 99% of people. You know, that's a huge number, right? It only takes 3% of a population to declare a pandemic. The Ponderosa that we're all currently sitting in, right? Like, you know, that's only 3%. Once you tick those numbers up to 47%, 99%, it seems overwhelming. So it takes a lot of energy to be able to, like, communicate that to people. And it takes time. People want, like, a one and done, quick and easy, we just want to solve this problem, move on, and get back to the music. That's not the way that it works. You can talk to Dana. It took, what, like, 16 months?
Yeah.
For us to fully develop, like, the policies. And don't let that intimidate you either. Like, oh, my God, we don't have 16 months, right? When we talk about 16 months, like, I think it was, like, the first few months was, like, the policy development, right? And getting everything down on paper. So that takes a little bit of time. But then after that, it's implementation. So that's usually where people fall off. They write down the policy. They go, oh, we have a policy. We put up some posters. We had a team meeting. We're good. No. Implementation. That means that you have to train people and you have to keep training people. Think about how you do see, the thing is that we all know how to do this, actually. Like, y'all are actually really, really, really good at training new people to come in and do work that they may have never done before. Training new people to come in and take over roles that turn over quickly, right? Like, that's kind of the nature of, like, this business, that a lot of times the same person who was here today is not going to be the same person who was here next year. So that means you have to continually keep telling people, you have to continually keep training people, and you also have to keep having to refine the kind of training that you do. I can tell you 15 years ago, it was preferred gender pronouns. Now we don't say preferred gender pronouns because gender is not a preference. right? And it's just your pronouns. But we didn't know that 15, 20 years ago. And that's language that had to evolve. Same thing goes when it comes to preventing sexual harassment or sexual violence. It is an evolution. It is a thought process. It is something that you have to continually learn about, continually refine, and also listen to the folks around you. So that's what I love about the process with First Ave, is that y'all sat down with your staff and with former staff and former people who were a part of the community and said, well, what do you think? And what happened? And what should we do? That's an important piece of it. When people are invested and they have the ability to create those community guidelines with you, in collaboration with you, they're much more likely to really embody that and really carry that forward. And so those are the three things that, like, you have to think about. Have we, like, admitted that there's a problem? Can we literally look around and say that there's a problem and not, like, beat ourselves up for it? Two, can we commit some money to paying the people who know how to do this to help us do this? And three, can we put the time in? And I'm going to say, like, a bonus, which is four, is a balance of holding yourself accountable, saying we're not doing enough, and also giving yourself some grace and saying, but at least we're working on it, right? Because nobody's perfect. And I feel like this is a topic especially that if you don't go in perfectly, if you don't go in hitting everything, like, boom, 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 the way you should, you feel like somebody's going to come and, like, yell at you and be like, you're doing it wrong. Like, and that, like, no, not at all. Just make the effort and take that first step of saying it's a problem and then figuring out who can come in and help you support that.
I'm curious, in terms of taking action based off of demand, if there's, and maybe Dana, you can speak to this, if there's been kind of like a demand or expectation from fans for venues and promoters to be prepared, you know, have a space that is prepared for them to have a safe experience. And if there, that demand is there from fans, is that what's going to push the envelope for other promoters and venues?
There needs to be more demand from fans, I will say. Like, that has, we have not even, you know, in Minneapolis, which is an exceptionally, like, progressive, woke city where people are very, like, concerned about social justice, like, we really didn't see it all that much. It mm-hmm. came a lot from our staff, and it came, you know, from our, like, own internal, you know, desires. You know, there's a handful of people, but I would say, like, demand is different from, because there's productive demand, and then there's the keyboard warriors that just want to, like, criticize everything you're doing, right? And I think, you know, back to an earlier question of, like, why aren't people doing this? Like, it's really fucking hard.
Yeah.
It's really
yes.
messy. Mm-hmm. There's no, like, we're used to, like, you give me $5, I give you a beer, right? Like, that's kind of, in a lot of ways, the business. And, like, mm-hmm. there is no equation. There's, like, no easy or there's just no right or wrong way to do it. So, certainly, you know, I think a lot of people wish we had done more, and a lot of people wished we hadn't done anything at all. And so, mm-hmm. you know, in some ways, you're just trying to do, like, the best you can. But, no, there hasn't been as much from fans. I mean, we haven't gotten a lot of pushback from the code of conduct. I don't know if people aren't seeing it until they're, you know, kicked out. But, like, but I think, you know, for us, like, really one of the key was just making sure our staff knew that, like, this code of conduct was to be enforced and that no one, like, you know, not only were you not going to get punished or fired or anything if you did report something, like, that was actually a quality that we valued at our company. And that was a key, like, turning point for us. So it was more employee-based than it was fan-based.
Yeah, I mean, I'm curious how to kind of get more fan buy-in, really. I mean, obviously, there's, we were talking about the ecosystem of the concert or the venue, let's say, and how do you kind of create, like, a cultural moment within that concert where everybody is, like, there to look out for each other and have each other's back. And I would say even, like, look out for, like, the people on stage, like, think about the entire ecosystem. And I'm just curious how, I really don't know the answer to this, but how to like, engage fans in that a little bit more so that there's maybe is a little bit more pressure to create that code of conduct or to create that understanding in the space that everybody is buying in. And I don't know if that's like, maybe you can also just let us know, like, you know, other than like clicking that box when you buy a ticket, is there like signage up? Like, how do people know that you've gone through those steps and that that space is there for them?
Yeah, I mean, we have it, you know, on our website, on, you know, the same as like our vaccine policy, kind of every place where ticket buyers are and we're advertising. But I think it's a little bit tricky from the venue promoter side because, you know, our audience changes every night. If we have, you know, a country artist or a hip-hop artist or a rock artist or a local artist, like, you know, I think also the fan pressure follows artists as much as it does the venues. But I think certainly, like, holding venues and promoters accountable, if they are promoting artists, you see it problematic. We certainly hear about it, you know. But, you know, I think, you know, it's just hard when you're talking to, like, 15 different, you know, very distinct subsects of customers.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I basically have the same question about like artists too. So, you know, what's their responsibility here and what can they do to, you know, aid in the success of moving this entire endeavor forward? Because even if say like it's in the contracts, which is amazing, does, you know, the contract goes to the agent, goes to the lawyer, goes to the manager. At what point is that really, you know, engaging the artist in, you know, having a platform, having a protocol, having a pledge? And I'm curious, Kelly, like if there's, from your point of view with Safe Tour, like what you've seen from the artist side in terms of like getting the artist on board as like what you're saying in terms of like the leader of the entire, you know, on tour crew, everybody who is like following that person. And you even think about like the fans at that show, like everybody is following that person. And, you know, and I know every artist doesn't want to have to get up and like have a platform. So I'm just curious what you yeah. think artists can do maybe in various ways.
Yeah. I mean, I think every artist has to have to go with, some artists have more power than others, right? I mean, first and foremost, I think that artists as creatives and as cultural leaders need to set the example by putting protocols in place for their own staff and their own crew and raising the bar. If they haven't set a bar, they need to set a bar. Mm-hmm. If they've set a bar, maybe they need to raise it a little bit. Because right now, really what's happening in the touring world is it's just sort of, you know, everyone's just sort of hoping the artist is cool and that everybody acts cool. Like, that's sort of the protocol right now. So I think really putting some things into place that make that statement. And then I think there's also a way to go back and to say, you know, hey, if I'm playing at this venue, I expect my fans to be safe, which means maybe I ask the venue to make sure that security at the venue is able to, you know, manage unsafe situations, to have a safe space for their fans. You know, I think the artist has a big responsibility. I mean, I think you can't put it all on the artist. I think, honestly, I just think everybody's chipping away from all these different spaces. So if you're a video vendor, you should be training your video staff no matter what tour they're on. If you have a sort of a problem child, you shouldn't just pluck them off that tour and onto a tour where maybe they don't seem as big a problem. You should deal with your staff. And then as a venue, same thing. You know, I think everybody has to work on their part of it. I think the artists that have the money and the power to put training into place need to do so. I think one of the only things we haven't, which I think you had a little bit, Nikki, is just that I think a lot of times people think, well, if I open this can of worms, God knows what's going to jump out. The liability is going to jump out of this can and strangle us. And the truth is the liability is there already. Like that, we're not creating liability. We're actually finding ways to mitigate it and to help the mental health of our staff and our world and our culture, you know? And so I think that, you know, I don't want to speak strictly from a liability standpoint because I think we're all here because it's bigger than compliance for us. But if I need to speak from a liability standpoint, I will, because it's really important, you know? I mean, this is a business, and we need to do things right in our business. Yeah. There's a reason we had COVID protocol. I mean, this isn't magic. This is business.
I'm curious because I mean, I know that the subject is like heavy and feels negative and feels like overwhelming. And I'm just curious if we could shift and like talk about maybe some positive outcomes, like things that you guys have seen with the work that you're doing or the shifts that you have made, the new protocols, all of that. I mean, I think that obviously like coming through the Me Too movement, I'm just curious kind of like what were, have things changed? Are we seeing improvement? Are we seeing positive things out there? I mean, what can we look to as those examples?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's I think of everything as a spectrum because that's just an annoying part of who I am. Nothing is fixed to me. So I feel like, yes, the needle has definitely moved on this conversation. I think about like a band we work with often, which is Dispatch, which is like a band of like all like straight white dudes. And they are all about this. Like they put, you know, our staff members on tour with them. So we table at every show. We like help train like their security. We help train the security at the venues that they're going to be at. And they have really embodied this and taken this on. And because it's like, you know, and again, like my apologies if I'm offending anyone, but it's really real. If it's four straight white dudes who are like, yeah, we take sexual harassment and not allowing that at our shows seriously. Unfortunately, the world that we still live in is that has a much farther ripple effect than like, let's say if I go on tour and I'm like, you should all care about sexual harassment. And everyone's going to be like, well, yeah, of course you think that. Right. Like, so, you know, the optics matter. And I think now we have, you know, language for certain things like consent culture. Everybody knows like what it means to like get consent, right? Or to not have consent. That's really helpful. The other thing I want to say too, in response to like compliance and liability, those things are important. But I think it's also important to remember that at the root of all arts and especially music is human dignity, right? This is an art form that uplifts and centers the human experience. So if we are like experiencing something that takes away from somebody's human dignity in our space, at our shows, at our festivals, that to me is not acceptable, not for us as creatives, not for us as human beings, producers, organizers, whatever role you play, that shouldn't be acceptable. I wanted to give you one example too of like a festival that has made it easy for people to get help without them feeling like they're gonna be like criminalized or penalized, and that's Bonnaroo. Mm-hmm. So like years ago, they would have people that had like, you know, security like shirts on, and now that shifted to safety, right? And like medical and like, you know, whatever it is, we just want to make sure that you're okay. And we're not about to like call the cops because like, you know, you are having a bad experience with like shrooms or whatever, right? Because that's the kind of thing people worry about, like especially when they're under the influence. So I think if you can take away the stigma of like, you're going to get in trouble and just give people like pathways to like exit situations with dignity, whether they're the harm doer or whether they're the person being harmed, I think that that's important. And that has an ultimate cultural ripple effect where we can then just begin to talk about these things and like get them out into the open. It's the silence, honestly, that's gonna like make none of this possible. So speak up.
So one of the things that I think is really important about this panel, this topic, and kind of moving forward on your journey, our journey through all of this is obviously there's no end. It's over. I did this one thing, it's over. And so I'm curious if, you know, before we leave this room, if we can talk a little bit about some action items. You know, again, I know the topic is really overwhelming. Everybody has different experiences and backgrounds, and I want to kind of, you know, talk about like the easiest form of action that we can all take here. To like maybe the most complicated, I guess, the most complicated, maybe 16 months of, but you're here.
That's 16 months
of yeah, like thank, absolutely. Thank you to everyone for being here. That's really your first step.
Yes.
I also wanted to just remind you about the QR code and our resource page, and also that we have a free training for you. And you can absolutely share that. You can sign up at the resource page. And then we also, just with the donations, we'll be able to give away a free group training, whether that's like an artist and their whole crew, management company, venue, promoter. That's really exciting. So, and that definitely anyone who may be interested in can't afford that, we would love for people to enter that. So the research page is a great first step if you want to go there. But I wanted to just like, you know, any ideas that you guys have that you can throw out for the folks here, but then also obviously so important, and we would love for you to talk about these organizations and implementation, like with all your friends here at South by Southwest, everyone you're going to run into, think about it when you're here at shows and share it with the people around you. So I don't know if you, any of you have some.
I mean, one simple one is just whatever, wherever you are in the spectrum of the music and entertainment and arts, continue to have the conversation with people who, you know, if you've got a certain amount of power over a decision that you can help bring in some training, bring in some awareness, bring in some new protocol. If you're not in that position, but you're in the position to have that conversation with someone who is, I think just keeping the conversation alive is a really simple way to.
I agree.
Yeah. I mean, you know, like anything that is new to you that you might not know anything about, or something you might want to know more about, you know, Google. Google is your friend. You know, read some books, read some articles. Like, in addition to that conversation, I feel like that's the second step, is that you have to kind of like learn about the dynamics of why and how all of this exists. Now, you might not nerd out on it the way that I do, because I really do nerd out on it, and I got all these statistics and stuff and data in my brain all the time. But even just like watching a video, right, of somebody who has like been impacted, even I think like what's remarkable, and I love what First Ave has done, which is just sit down and how, and like listen to people. So conversation, but also providing a space where people can really keep it real with you, and you're not gonna weaponize that vulnerability. You're not gonna punish them for saying like what has been true for them, and you're not gonna judge them for that either. And just being able to hold that space with them and say, okay, I get it, I understand. And then, you know, doing some deep reflection on it. It's a process, you know? It is really step by step. And like, you know, the way I think of it is like every day, what step can I take, or how can I add to my knowledge, or how can I just move myself further on that spectrum? Also, it is not a race, right? So you don't have to go like balls to the wall. It might take you a minute, because also vicarious trauma is a thing. And so I want to let you know that too, that when you're taking in stories of sexual harassment, or maybe you're the person who's the venue manager who's managing these complaints and this harassment, that stuff is going to impact you. So also making sure that you're taking care of yourself, and if you're a person who has a staff of people, making sure that they have ways of taking care of themselves. So mental health resources, making sure that folks can, you know, access therapy like through the health insurance you might provide, simple things like that. There's a lot of different ways that you can like start to like chip away at this.
Great, thank you.
Yeah, I mean, I think first, you know, not getting overwhelmed by, you know, the nebulous nature of the work, and, you know, understanding and being willing to just say like, okay, I'm going to do something that's like not linear, and there might not be a right or wrong, and like being okay, just living in that kind of gray area. And I would say like the crawl, like if you have a company, or if you, you know, are in charge of people, making it clear like what your values are and what's acceptable and what is unacceptable, and creating that safe space to like really listen to how people feel. I think that was probably the key and set us down that 16-month journey, for better or for worse. And then, you know, if you are an artist, you know, again, with your crew, like making sure that everyone knows what is acceptable, what is not acceptable. I mean, I just, one of the key moments I'll never forget it is, in one of our forums, somebody's like, well, what do you define it? Like, what is sexual harassment? What do you need to prove it? And when I was like, oh, well, not like a police report, if that's at all what you're thinking. And like one girl started crying. Like it was so deeply emotional. So just making clear like what your values are, and make sure that everybody knows. And then if you're a fan, you know, email your local venue or promoter and ask them what they're doing to help keep you safe. Because I think a lot of folks aren't having these conversations. And even just like maybe, you know, triggering that internal conversation and making them look and say, like, oh, what am I doing to make sure my audience is safe and my artists are safe, you know, might trigger something.
And Calling All Crows has a fan training, so you could also take that.
It's true.
So I'm going to wrap up. I don't know if there's any questions. I wanted to thank South by Southwest, the panelists, yeah. Christina London, yeah. Grace Jones. This has been really a dream to do this panel, so yeah. I'm going to jump to everybody. I think there's a microphone in the back
if you guys
for questions.
Mind,
that would be really helpful.
Yeah, because they're recording the session, so we'll be able to hear your questions, which
that would
important.
Be great.
Sorry, I didn't mean to cut
you off.
No,
that was good. I was going to say the same thing.
I'm LJ. Hi, Dana. Nice to see
Hi.
You. Hi, Amy. Nice to see
Hi.
You. I think this is my 12th year coming to South by Southwest, not consecutively, obviously. 27 years in the music business, most of it on the live touring side. I say this. It sounds dramatic, but I think that this is true. This is probably the most powerful panel that I have been in for women in music since I started coming here. It is a privilege to be in the room with you. And Amy, thank you for putting this together.
Thank you.
I'm also saddened that we are in this room together talking about this. I work in mindfulness. I'm the founder of Comuse, which is the mindful business community for music and tech. And we bring a level of emotional intelligence to professional development for both individuals and organizations. You talked about how do we get the fans involved? How do we get more people on this bandwagon? And what comes to mind is what you said, Dana, earlier, is it's very transactional business historically. You know, you give us $5 and we give you the beer. What comes to mind for me is the ecology of our business is transactional. So we should begin to reward the behavior that we wish to see. Maybe there is a reward system for fans that came to mind as you were speaking. A question now, sorry. What can women do who are just starting out in this business? Maybe they're coming out of university, or maybe they skip college and they're just super passionate about getting into the biz. What can they do as an individual to have these kinds of conversations without any former experience to lean on? What could be one single thing that they could bring into their next chapter or first chapter? Thank you.
Thank you, LJ.
Thank you.
Yeah, your words were just so kind and affirming. Thank you so much for saying all of those wonderful things. And congrats on, you know, just sticking around in an industry that is not always the easiest place to stick around. So kudos to that. I would say that, like, the way that, you know, I got involved, that a way a lot of people get involved is by volunteering. And so I think volunteering, whether it comes to, like, your local, you know, Rape Crisis Organization, you could do that. But, like, you know, you can volunteer with us. I'm sure you can volunteer with, you know, with Safe Tour. You can't volunteer with First Ave because you guys are a for-profit business. But you can volunteer with the organizations that are, like, local to them and that you know, are supporting the work that they do. So I would say that is to first take a look around, do, like, a field survey and figure out, you know, who is doing this work, who is interested in this work, and who is just maybe supporting people in your city when it comes to this kind of harm. And then just putting some time into that. Usually they'll give you, like, you know, like I'll say for, like, Resilience in Chicago, which I worked at 1.5 million years ago, they'll, you know, if you volunteer to be an advocate with them, you get a 60-hour training in the dynamics of all of this. Now, you know, that's a lot. Not everybody is, like, wanting to do all of that, right? But I think volunteering is a great, like, entry point in terms of digging in a little bit deeper and feeling like you're doing something, like, active to learn more about this.
Yeah, I was also going to say, in terms of, like, you know, somebody's own empowerment, the bystander intervention training is really amazing. It's not 60 hours. And you all can do it for 30 minutes if you sign up. And that... I think that gives each individual some ownership over action, and there's various different ways of taking action. And so if somebody wants to feel like they are empowered as just a newbie, I mean, regardless of gender, newbie in the music business, and want to make sure that they're not stuck in a weird power dynamic, which they probably are, having those tools, I think, are really important for feeling like you have options for talking about anything that might be happening to you or others around you, and how you kind of can take action based on what's comfortable for you. So I think that is, you know, maybe, yeah, not 60 hours, but I think it will help anybody.
Yeah. We'll say that the best advice, I think for young women, I think that was the question starting out, is find a mentor who will respect you and you can be honest with and ask all the stupid questions too. I mean, like, we're all here because of your guys' relationship, right? And it's like your generation that's bringing this issue to the forefront. So, that's like, right. I think having that community and having that support can help navigate, like, very, very tricky waters. Because, again, it's not black and white. It's this industry kind of lives in this gray area, you know?
Yeah, that's great, There's another question.
Hi there.
Hi.
I'm James from Energain, the strategic HR firm for the music ecosystem. And I have a very diverse team, and we do a lot of anti-harassment training with our clients. But I've got to say, this talk was just standout inspiring. I mean, just, I work on a team where we've got practitioners, but this was really just an amazing conversation. I love the reference to the four white guys in the band. Love that. No offense taken. And this upstander idea in the training. So my question is a very direct one. Like, what advice would you have to the white guys in the room, or to the people that might be in a different situation to be an upstander? What can we do? We want to make that ripple effect. So what advice do you have for people that want to make a difference?
I actually have an example as a booking agent. I have a young band that all men who had some kind of unsavory things that had happened with people around them, people who they had worked with, somebody who used to be in their band who they got rid of. And that kind of reputation was following them around, and they were trying to do everything they could to, squash it, essentially. You know, they were donating money. They just were, with the tools they had, they were doing what they thought they could. They put up a statement, and kept touring. And they still had fans or people who were kind of calling them out and, trying to just nail them with that reputation forever, right? And so we had a really honest conversation, them, the whole team, manager, the agents, about, like, what do you really want with your career? What do you want with your fans and the space when you're out on tour? Like, what's actually the goal? Let's stop talking about, like, trying to defend all of the things that happened that you've tried to do. Like, what is really, where do we want to go with this? And they were like, well, we just want a safe space for our fans, right? So how do you move forward with that intention? And so they put together their own pledge for everyone in the band, everyone who worked with them. They partnered with an organization that's based in Chicago called Our Music, My Body. And they put together trainings for everyone. And then they, at every tour stop, every city, they partnered with a local organization to table. And they put that messaging out there for their fans, that this is what we believe in. This is what we want for you. And to stop being so reactionary to what was being sent their way in terms of what their past had been and who they had been involved with, but to say, no, this is our career forever. This is the long haul. Like, we want this space to be positive for everybody who's here. And to just say, like, we're changing this culture. This is what we're doing now. We don't, you know, we don't need to keep answering to the people who are trying to take us down. We actually want to create this space. And there's not one woman on their team except for me. So, you know, it was really important for them, I think, to have that transformative moment too, to have the conversation, to talk about what it meant. They learned so much. And I think that they felt really empowered to create that environment for their fans. So,
yeah. Let me tack on something too. Get comfortable with being uncomfortable. That's the first step for anybody who's trying to step into a community or trying to create diversity or work with people who are not necessarily like them, right? Is that you have to get really good with being uncomfortable. Sometimes it means you're going to take some hits that you might not deserve, right? That's what that means sometimes, is that you're going to take in some stuff from people because there's a history behind all of this, right? There's decades, there's generations that has led to us in this moment now. So because of that, if you can get comfortable with that, you can get like comfortable with being uncomfortable and really like provide that room for people to say what they have to say authentically. And as Amy said, come from a place of proactivity versus reactivity. You don't have to be like on the defensive. You know what I mean? Like, I know it's real in vogue to like take down all the like straight white guys, but I know that like y'all are all not evil. Like, I know that my grandmama was white. I get it. You know, like that's not, you know, that's also not like where everyone's coming from. But at the same time, I think being aware that there is a history, there's a context, there's a place where all of this is coming from. It's not just like showing up out of nowhere. So if you can get good with being uncomfortable and having those real honest conversations, that can get you to that place, I think, of really centering that human dignity with everybody and having those good generative conversations.
Great, thank you.
Yeah. Oh, do we have time for another?
Oh.
Can we do one more? Just one. Or are we just done? Yeah. Okay.
Okay.
You can come find us and ask your questions.
Yes. Okay. Come meet us out there. Yeah, we will talk to you out there.
Yeah, yeah. Thank you all for coming so much. Also,
thank you so much.
I just want to remind everyone, you can donate to these organizations. You can tell your companies to donate to sponsor another group training. Sign up for the mini bystander intervention training. Submit whoever you want who cannot afford the group training to enter to win the free one, and donate. Yeah, there you go. Money.
Yeah.
Okay. Thanks, everyone.
Thank
Have a great Southwest.
Thank you.
Great job.